two films, one theme. This is Words and Movies.
Thank you, Rebecca, and welcome to yet another edition of Words and Movies. I am Claude Call.
And I'm Sean Gallagher. And this episode is part three of our Aaron Sorkin Fest.
Yay!
And this, of course, is being done in honor of his new movie, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, which is currently on Netflix and which I actually saw. We might talk a little bit about that on our last episode of Sorkin Fest, but for now, we're going to talk about the two movies he wrote right before that one, Steve Jobs, which was directed by Danny Boyle, and Molly's Game, directed by Sorkin himself. And the other reason why I paired these two together, or I should say we paired these two together, is they both deal with a theme that has interested Sorkin in his past work, and also a storytelling device that is Sorkin has used in his past work. And we'll get more into that when we talk about the movies. But for now, Claude's going to give us the synopsis for Steve Jobs.
Yeah, so Steve Jobs, this might be Sorkin's most linear film so far from a storytelling standpoint. And it's not so much a biopic of Steve Jobs, so much as it is a series of snapshots in his life, depicting mostly the goings-on that take place shortly before three big events in Jobs' life. And in each snapshot, there are three storylines going on. And I'm actually going to even back off on biopic, because it's not quite even that. But anyway, we start in 1984. It's a few days after the cinematic Macintosh commercial that Apple ran during the Super Bowl, and Jobs, portrayed by Michael Fassbender, is about to unveil the computer itself at the Flint Center. With only an hour to go before the unveiling, the 128K Max voice demo isn't working. Jobs tells software engineer Andy Hertzfeld to fix it, basically by threatening to expose him as the person solely responsible for the failure. Hertzfeld suggests faking it for the time being by using a prototype 512K Mac for the demo. Now, while all this is going on, Jobs is ranting to his marketing executive, Joanna Hoffman, played by Kate Winslet, about an article in Time magazine about a paternity dispute he's going through with his ex-girlfriend, Chris Ann, portrayed by Catherine Waterston here. And she also happens to be backstage at the event, along with Lisa, the child he denies is his. Jobs manages to bond with Lisa a little bit because she is taken very quickly to the ease of the Mac's use, and she's done an abstract picture in Mac Paint. As a result, he agrees to give Chris Ann some additional money for support. The third story in 1984 involves Steve Wozniak, played by Seth Rogen. Now, Woz is mostly just asking Jobs to give a quick shout out to the team that developed the Apple II, but Jobs thinks the machine is obsolete and he wants to look forward, not back. We transition to 1988 through a series of archival clips. The Macintosh has failed pretty spectacularly, and Jobs has been fired from the company that he co-founded. When we finally land in 1988, Lisa is now 9 years old, and Jobs has founded a new company called Next. Once again, it's before a big rollout. Jobs has been spending time with Lisa, but he still thinks Chris Ann is irresponsible and only using the girl to get money out of him. Wozniak comes to visit and predicts that the next computer is going to be another expensive failure, but Jobs is mostly upset about the statements that Woz made to the press after his firing. Woz wonders aloud what Jobs specifically does when it comes to computers. After all, he's not a designer nor a software engineer, and Jobs compares himself to the conductor of an orchestra. Apple CEO Steve Scully also shows up and demands to know why everyone thinks he fired Jobs, and it's here that we get a flashback where we learn that it was Jobs who forced the board vote that got him ejected, despite Scully warning him not to. Joanna confronts Jobs about the direction of Next, and she has an epiphany. Jobs was never going to release the Next computer. It was basically an expensive feint to get Apple to buy the company and bring him back in. We now move to 1998. Scully has been fired from Apple. The company has indeed bought Next and reinstated Jobs as their new CEO. Jobs is about to unveil the iMac, and this time Joanna's marketing predictions are looking very positive. Jobs is preoccupied by the fact that Chris Ann has sold the house he paid for, and we learn that he's taking it out on Lisa, threatening to withhold her tuition to Harvard. Joanna is furious about this, and she tells him that Hertzfeld already paid for Lisa's first semester, which further enrages him. Jobs confronts Hertzfeld, and he admits he did pay the tuition and that he was the one who suggested Lisa go into therapy. Wozniak again asked for a little love for the Apple II team, but despite a very public argument in the theater, Jobs refuses again. Scully secretly arrives backstage, and he and Jobs make amends. Their conversation about Jobs being an adopted child and how that may have shaped him causes him to have a little bit of an epiphany, and he finds Lisa, telling her that he was made poorly, and he acknowledges that he's her father. And we close on Lisa watching from the wings as Jobs takes the stage to unveil the iMac.
Okay, so one slight correction here. The character Scully, who's played by Jeff Daniels.
Yes, I left that out. I'm sorry.
Is actually named John Scully, not Steve.
How did I do that? You're right.
One thing we should very briefly mention is that this was one of the many films whose details got thrown in the public eye because of the infamous Sony hack that took place around a little before the movie was released, where we learned, among other things, that David Fincher was originally going to direct this, but for various reasons, he passed. Christian Bale and Leonardo DiCaprio were in talks for the role, but they also passed. And there was some grumbling among some of the studio executives that this movie would not be something that they could really sell to the public.
You know, and I did see some of that, and I would have liked to have seen Christian Bale in this role. I think he would have done a pretty good job.
Excuse the expression. You know, that is, as they say, water under the bridge.
Yeah.
Anyway, this movie ended up being directed, of course, by Danny Boyle and is based on a biography by Walter Isaacson. And I can't remember who it was that said this. It might have been the real life Andy Hertzfeld or someone else who said that as far as the movie was concerned, nothing happened the way it's depicted in the movie exactly, but everything is true. All of what gets talked about in the movie, including the fact that the next was a Trojan horse move by Jobs to get Apple to hire him back, was in Isaacson's book. If there's anyone who disputes the movie for the facts, they should dispute Isaacson's biography of Jobs instead, I think, because it's all in there with the one exception of the fact that in the movie, Scully and Jobs reconcile. As I recall from Isaacson's biography, they don't, but it works for the movie, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. And in fact, most of the people who, the real life people who were there, you know, have much the same thing to say. It's like, it really didn't happen that way, but a lot of the stuff that is said to have happened, yeah, kind of happened, sort of, but not at all the way it happened in the film. That seems to be like the general consensus. Like if you ask Wozniak, who is listed as a consultant on the film, if I recall correctly, Scully, basically everybody who has any connection to Jobs has said, you know, this isn't quite what happened, but yeah, it did. And I think the best comparison I saw was somebody who wrote that it was kind of like they compared it to Citizen Kane, in that the film was clearly about William Randolph Hearst, and yet William Randolph Hearst was never mentioned. And so it's like a lot of the same events that happened in Hearst's life happened in Kane, but they gave themselves plausible deniability by not naming any names. In this case, we went with real names and told a story parallel to what happened in real life.
And it's appropriate that you bring up Kane, because what I mentioned at the outset about the storytelling device that Sorkin is fond of, that he uses in this movie, is the fact that he always seems to be looking for that rosebud for a character that will explain what a character is and why they're like this. And we get that in the flashback for the third act, where Jobs is having dinner with Scully at a restaurant and inviting him to become Apple's CEO. This takes place before 1984. And you see the owner of the restaurant there, and you come to learn that that's his father, the one who gave him away or gave him up.
Right. But it's also important to note that the restaurant owner has no idea of their relationship.
Yes, exactly. And that, for Sorkin anyway, seems to be the rosebud for Jobs's life. And he uses that partly as you mentioned, an epiphany, and partly as a linchpin to draw his characterization of Jobs. And he's used that kind of rosebud instance or storytelling device on his TV shows in the past, but not so much in his movies. This is the first one that you really see that type of device in, although we'll also see it when we talk about Molly's Game next. And it might seem like it's part of the usual Hollywood simplifying of Freud, where their version of Freud, especially in movies from the 40s, when psychiatry and psychoanalysis was starting to be depicted in a big way then, as showing, oh yes, the one childhood incident that, once you clear that up, solves everything. Which, as I said, is a very simplistic view of some complicated psychology. But because he layers it so much with what else is going on, it doesn't come off as simplistic here as it might in lesser hands.
Right. And the other thing is that it's not as though you get the breadcrumbs that lead to that reveal. You know, I mean, you know, Jobs is, he's got some unusual behaviors, and by all accounts, again, like that scene where he sticks his feet in the toilet to calm himself down is something that Jobs would do, you know? And it wasn't, my understanding is it wasn't originally in the script. That was something that Fassbender found out about. And he says, well, I got to do this somewhere in the film. But you have this person who is, you know, a little bit of a jerk, but he's just driven, okay, to move in a certain direction. He is a certain kind of guy. He behaves a certain way. He's a little bit on the harsh side, or at least very, very, he's just very used to saying exactly what's on his mind, I guess. And we don't get any weird little hints at this is the reason for the way he behaves, until we get to the end, and then we have this reveal that, oh yes, well, we know he was adopted. That came up earlier. And we know that he may have some sort of issues with having been adopted. But we don't get anything that says until that very last moment that, oh yeah, he knows who his father is. And it's this guy that he actually goes and visits on a regular basis. And the guy knows him only as the famous person who comes to visit his restaurant. And so it's not as though, like with Kane, you get Rosebud. It's like the first word of the entire movie. And then we move forward trying to figure out what Rosebud is. This is something that gives you a little bit of, oh, okay, I kind of get why he's doing this and why he is behaving this way with Lisa and so on.
They don't drop any breadcrumbs along the way. But if you are able to study his behavior, you can sort of understand that he might have some issues there, which again is a theme of Sorkin's that he explored in his TV shows, the theme of parental issues. You know, you saw that all the time. You saw that a couple times on Sports Night. You saw that quite a bit on The West Wing. It was portrayed in perhaps his worst writing moment on Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. As I was reminded this week when I heard someone mention the line about someone dying in Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah.
That was not a good moment for him. But it's explored well here. And he did touch on parental issues in A Few Good Men. Remember, Tom Cruise's character in that is living in the shadow of a famous dead father.
Right.
And at the time, you know, people thought, oh, that's all Cruise. Look how many movies he did before that where he had where he played characters dealing with father issues. But it turns out that he and Sorkin were kindred spirits in that regard, or at least from a fictional standpoint. And it's going to come into a major play in Molly's Game when we talk about that. You were mentioning about the fact that Jobs is more than a bit of a jerk in what we see of him. One of the core, I guess, ideas from Isaacson's biography that gets shown in this movie is the fact that Jobs saw himself as an artist. Matter of fact, in the book, he specifically divides the world into two types of people. Hacks, who he considers totally inferior, and he uses the word hacks a couple times in the movie, and artists, who he completely respects. You know, you get that whole part that you mentioned where he's talking about the conductor, mm-hmm. and you can feel the reverence in his tone. And then later, when he's talking about Alan Turing in the third segment, and I'm going to get back to that as well a little later, you can hear the reverence there. And he saw himself like that. Now, one thing that's only barely touched on in the movie, when you see John Scully looking at a couple of pictures, is that Jobs was also involved with Pixar Studios, who, of course, is the studio famous for making computer animated classics like the Toy Story movies and The Incredibles. And because he saw them as artists, he generally treated them very well. So if ever anyone decided to make a fictional account of the creation of Pixar, there's already been a documentary about it. Let's just say, if they had Jobs as a character, you'd see a very different portrayal of him than we see here. But what's interesting about the fact that Jobs is shown here as seeing himself as an artist is that in a lot of movies made about artists who are genius in their craft, but difficult to live with otherwise, the attitude seems to be, well, okay, they're difficult, but they're also a genius. Here, Sorkin is taking it the other way around. You know, Woz in the third segment tells him straight off that it's not binary. You can be a genius and still be a good person. Mm-hmm. Joanna calls him out on not being a good father to Lisa. And Lisa, of course, gives him a blistering takedown near the end about not being a good person. So it's not the type of thing you'd expect from Sorkin to delve into so much about debunking the myth of the great white artist who's nonetheless difficult, but we should put up with their difficulty.
Yeah, and I think it's also in the third act alone where we don't get that conversation between Woz and Jobs about comparing a computer to a painting.
Right. Yes. No, that's in the first act, especially in the flashback of the first act. And then they recut to that when every time Waz tries to say computers aren't paintings, Jobs cuts them off with an obscenity.
Yeah.
So now another aspect that I want to get to is the fact that although I don't mean this as something bad to say, and although Boyle does a very good job cinematically making each three acts visual and distinctive. The first act was shot in 16 millimeter, the second in 35 millimeter, and the last act was shot on digital to show the technological advances that have been gone through all the years as well. And then you get little things like when Joanna figures out what the purpose of Next is, in the end of the second act, you see footage along the walls of rockets taking off.
The wall turns into a screen, basically.
Yes. But having said all that, Steve Jobs is arguably the most theatrical movie that Sorkin has ever written. It's a clear three-act structure. He brings characters back to do the same kind of things that they were doing in each act, each of the previous acts. The breaks between the first and second act and the second and third act are broken up by news footage, which you could basically call a Greek chorus.
Mm-hmm.
And you also, for each of the acts, you get a little climax at the end that's supposed to signify the end of one and the beginning of the next, or pointing towards the beginning of the next act. So I would not be surprised if somewhere along the line, assuming, of course, there is a line to come to in the world that we're living in today, if Sorkin decided to turn this into a play, because this really does feel like a play, even though it is clearly a work of cinema as well.
Yeah, it could easily be done. And, you know, the other thing that occurs to me is, in another sense, this is also his most TV kind of movie. And I say that in the sense that if you look at his TV projects, and I'm looking at all of them, Sports Night, West Wing, Studio 60, The Newsroom, okay, all of those give you basically the time in between what we see on TV, okay? So we don't see very much of, you know, the president on CNN. We don't see much of the sports night show, okay, on the air, except those transitions to and from commercials. We don't see any of the sketches on Studio 60, with a couple of unfortunate exceptions. You know, and only once in a while do we see Will McAvoy on camera. All right, everything is really all about what happens backstage. Okay, that's the focus of these shows. And likewise, this is the focus of this film, is like each of these three acts is what's taking place before the public sees what happens.
Yeah, so that's something that Sorkin has always been interested in. Now, there are a couple of, not many, but a couple of dialogue tropes that he does here, which he's done in the past, that I want to touch on real quick, about the fact that there's a confusion all the time. Which Andy are they referring to?
Right.
Andy Hertzfeld, the software engineer, or Andy Cunningham, the stage manager of the first and third events, who's played by Sarah Snook. And she, by the way, is one of only two characters who don't appear in all three segments. The other one is Chris Ann. And you also I'm sure the main reason that they call Steve Wozniak Woz throughout the entire movie is that so they didn't have to do that same joke with Steve Jobs and Woz and to keep them distinct.
Well, I mean, but he was also commonly referred to as Woz. I mean, that wasn't necessarily a device. I mean,
right. And then there's a little moment in the third act where Steve is trying to get Joanna to persuade Lisa to come backstage. And at one point he says to her, do that wise old European woman thing that you do, since her character is Polish American. And she says to him, you know, I wasn't born in a 19th century shtetl, right?
I loved that line.
Yes. And occasionally, more so on his TV shows than in the movies, but occasionally Sorkin likes to drop a little Yiddish. And as Toby says, he brings the Yiddish when he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, the captioning had a trouble with some of that Yiddish, by the way. It didn't always understand what he was talking about. I mean, at least I picked it up. And, you know, the funny thing is when I was doing the rewatch in prep for this, I was in a blood donation center. I was donating platelets, okay? And when you're donating platelets, you have a needle in each arm, all right? You are immobile for 2 hours while you're donating platelets. So there's one needle that's taking the blood, and they spin out the platelets, and they pop it back into the other arm with a little bit of plasma for you. Not plasma, with saline. And so I said, well, the blood center's got Netflix. I got to watch this movie. I might as well sit back and enjoy Steve Jobs. And, you know, everybody's got headphones on and masks and whatever else. And they got to that line about the shtetl. And I laughed out loud and got some weird looks in the blood center. But having said that, though, let me bring something up, though. It's like, while Sorkin likes to steal from himself, and that's pretty well documented, you know, here and everywhere else. And there's like Sorkin supercuts on YouTube and that kind of thing. I've also noticed that he's been taking some material from Peter Stone, and specifically the play 1776. And I know you don't want to talk about Trial of Chicago 7, and I haven't seen it yet, but this is something I saw in the preview, is that there's a line in the Trial of Chicago 7 that was in 1776, and there's a line from this film that was in 1776. I think he's a secret fan of 1776. I've never seen anything about the relationship between Aaron Sorkin and 1776, but he swiped at least two lines from that play.
You could be right. I've never seen the play, so I don't know, nor have I seen the movie version. However, I want to
that's going on the list right now. Okay.
Okay. I want to jump back to a couple things that are in the movie that I'm sure people thought, oh, that's just Sorkin again, stealing from himself or showing blah, blah, blah. He's out of touch with culture or he's stealing from himself. But according to Isaacson's biography, anyway, we're actually true to Steve Jobs's life. One thing is the fact that there are a couple times, particularly the scenes with Woz in the first and second acts that Jobs is meeting with, where they do a walk and talk. Yeah. Some people might say, oh, that's Sorkin again. But in fact, if you believe Isaacson's biography, which I guess some people don't, that was something that Jobs did in real life. He liked to have meetings on the go. Now, that sounds plausible because he comes across as someone who is constantly busy all the time. So, you know, he'd want to have these meetings on the go. And the other aspect of Jobs that's in here that you might think, and I saw the movie, I think, before I read the biography, so I might have even thought that when I saw the movie. But when Jobs is going over the Bob Dylan lyrics to use at the end of the first act, and in the third act during the argument that he has with Waz about, Waz saying to him, I'm tired of everyone thinking that I'm Ringo and that you were John. Mm-hmm. Again, Jobs was a huge Dylan fan. He actually, according to the biography, met him and was very impressed that Dylan lived up to his reputation. And he was also a Beatles fan. You have to remember that a lot of these California business moguls that sprung up in the 80s, like Ben and Jerry's and the guys behind Ben and Jerry's and Jobs and Wozniak, they came out of a 60s ethos. And so they would have been very much in tune with Dylan and the Beatles and the whole counterculture.
Sure.
So it's not like Sorkin is showing off his, once again, the fact that he's 20 years behind everyone on pop culture. This is, again, actually true to what Jobs is like. And there's a little mention that Jobs does about Joan Baez in the, I think it's the third act. He actually dated her for a while.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. So this is those parts that we might think are Sorkin are actually true to Jobs.
You know, the other thing about the walk and talk is like everybody seems to look at that as a Sorkin trope. And it's really more often than not a directorial choice, because there is just so much dialogue going on and nobody wants to shoot this static scene with two people sitting in a room just chit-chatting back and forth. So they turn it into a walk and talk, and then it becomes like Sorkin-esque. And it's kind of interesting that, I mean, I guess it started with Thomas Schlamme doing it with Sports Night and then later with The West Wing. But it also just became like this hallmark of anything written by Aaron Sorkin is, well, he's going to do these scenes, so we might as well shoot them with people in motion.
Actually, and I think I pointed this out on the first episode, it was started with Rob Reiner.
Yes, you did say that.
The first scene between Tom Cruise and Kevin Bacon, originally that just took place in a room. Here in the movie, however, they were doing a walk and talk.
Right. No, I get that. It did start back there. But the fact is, when you're doing, a couple of dozen episodes of Sports Night or, of The West Wing, and you encounter this phenomenon over and over again in the scripts of just these people yapping and yapping and yapping and yapping, and the director needs to give the character something to do. So while it started with Reiner, it was definitely like picked up and really codified into his material by Thomas Schlamme.
Right. Now, I had read the script before I saw the movie, as with The Social Network. And there are a couple of distinct differences between the script and the movie. In the first act, there's a wonderful exchange between Chris Ann, who, as you mentioned, is played by Catherine Waterston, daughter, by the way, of Sam Waterston, who is one of the stars on The Newsroom, and Joanne, where it's right around the time Chris Ann is trying to get Lisa to leave the room. And she makes a comment about Joanne's schooling. And Joanne said, no, I went to MIT. And Chris Ann says, oh, you're funny and smart too. I'm just wondering why you would work for someone like Jobs. And Joanne responds, for the health and dental. And I'm not sure why that line got cut out, but maybe they thought it was too much of a mood whiplash or something like that. I don't know, but I kind of wish they hadn't, because it's a really funny line. And then in the third act, when Steve Jobs is walking with Joel, the reporter, who's played by John Ortiz, very well, I should add.
Yeah.
And they're talking about Alan Turing, who I mentioned before. In the original script, Jobs does a mini biography of Turing, telling everyone who he was. And between the time that the script was written and the movie was released, The Imitation Game, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, about Turing's life during World War II, when he came up with the code that helped win World War II, or helped break the code, I should say, which helped win World War II, that movie had come out. So the speech that Jobs gives in the script is sort of superfluous. So they cut that down just to the fact that Jobs tells Joel he didn't include Turing in their presentation because he didn't know who Turing was. And also where he says that there should be statues of him and his name should be on the lips of every school child. So that was a necessary cut. And interestingly enough, the argument that Stephen Woz get into in the third act, in the original script, it's about Jobs firing the Apple IIe team. Whereas here, it's just that he wants them to mention them again.
Yeah, it's briefly mentioned that they're going to be fired. There is something about them being dismissed, but it's right. Kind of a throwaway.
So that makes Jobs look, I don't know, would you say less petty or even more petty? I'd have to go with more.
More, yeah. 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 I'm with you on that.
And then the final distinction from the script and the movie, and this is where I think the movie suffers in comparison. When Lisa gets into that whole argument with Jobs with her father in the waiting room before he goes on, and she ends with that send-off line about the computer looking like Judy Jetson's bake oven. After she takes off, in the script, Jobs says something to the effect of, there's no way in hell that that's not my daughter. And that's when he goes out after her. And then when they're out in the parking lot, he finally admits to her what Lisa stood for. The computer Lisa, which he had said in the first act was an acronym, Local Integrated Systems Architecture, something like that. Mm-hmm. In actuality, the joke around the office that he eventually came to admit was true, that it stood for Lisa Invented Stupid Acronym. And he says that to her. And to me, that would have made the scene much more meaningful and powerful of the two reconciling. And as it stands, it's still a good scene, but I was missing that extra emotional component there.
Yeah, well, I actually didn't mind cutting the line about there's no way in the world that this isn't my kid. That didn't bug me, losing that line. I knew that that had been cut out. I wasn't too sure about the other bit about the Lisa acronym, but I think that cutting that line actually made it a little bit stronger personally. You know, he has like a little bit of a moment and then he just goes after her. And I think this is a good example of like show, don't tell.
Right. And Danny Boyle in the commentary and also Sorkin in the commentary on the DVD say as much. And I can sort of see that about the first part. But the Lisa line, I think, was crucial, and I'm sorry that that was cut out. Now, do we have any more thoughts about this one before we move on to the next movie?
No, I am good for now. Why don't we take a quick break, and we will be right back.
Our next movie is Molly's Game, and this is the first movie that Sorkin also directed as well as wrote. And Claude's going to give us the synopsis here.
So this time we are looking at Molly Bloom, who is played by Jessica Chastain. She is a world-class skier who has Olympic aspirations, which are cut short when she injures herself badly during an event. Instead of attending law school, Molly takes a year off to live in Los Angeles. She gets a job as a bottle service waitress, where she meets Dean, a real estate developer, who is played by Jeremy Strong. Dean hires her to work for him, and he gets her to help him by running his underground poker games. Molly manages to make some big money entirely in tips for managing the games. She quickly learns how to appeal to the players to improve her tips, and she learns the ins and outs of running successful games. Now, Dean, sensing that she might be getting a little too independent, fires her, but by this time she's managed to make enough contacts that she can launch her own game. This goes well until Molly discovers that one of the biggest players, who's referred to only as Player X and is played by Michael Cera, has been engaged in some unethical activity related to her games. They have an argument, and Player X moves the games out from under her. Molly moves to New York City, hoping to start over again with her own game, and she is successful at it, but the problem is that she's essentially the bank for all these high rollers, and if any of them are unable to cover their debts, well, she'll be on the hook for it. Her dealer convinces her to take a percentage of large pots, and that immediately makes the games illegal. When one of her players is arrested, she's questioned and investigated about who's been playing her games, but she's not giving anyone up. However, the games are taking a toll on her, and she begins to abuse drugs. She's also starting admitting players who are members of the Russian mafia, and when the Italian mafia comes around looking for a piece of the action, she turns them down and she gets a savage beating as a result. The game is shut down for a few weeks while she recovers, but shortly before she returns to her game, the FBI raids the game and seizes her assets, and she returns to Colorado to live with her mother. Now, 2 years later, she writes a book about her adventures in which she names a few of the players involved. The FBI arrests her and indicts her for involvement with illegal gambling with the mafia, and she hires Charlie Jaffe, a high-profile attorney in New York, played by Idris Elba. He agrees to help her once he realizes that she's protecting innocent people who might be affected by her activities. And during the legal procedures, her father finds her and attempts to reconcile with her. Charlie manages to wrangle a great deal out of the Southern District attorneys, but Molly is not taking the deal because, again, it could affect a lot of innocent people. Instead, she pleads guilty, and the judge gives her the relatively lenient sentence of a $200,000 fine, probation, and 200 hours of community service.
Okay, and we should mention that this movie is based on Bloom's book, although the first edition of the book didn't really talk about the trial. And that was the edition that I read, or rather the pretrial, I should say, because all the trial consisted of was her pleading guilty and receiving the sentence. That so the movie is not only about the poker game, but it is also about that pretrial. And after that opening scene of her ski accident, which we also return to at the very end, the movie is told in flashback. It starts out with the raid on her home, and then it flashes back between the time that she spends getting involved in the games and the time she's with Charlie trying to work out what'll happen before the trial. One of the things about this movie, even though it is based on a true story, is that in the movie, and Molly states this right up front in the narration when we're in the ski sequence, that except for her name, all of the names in the movie are fictional.
Right.
There are no real people depicted, although Player X is heavily based on quite a few Hollywood actors who were involved in the game in Los Angeles, most notably Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, it's one of those worst kept secret kind of situations.
Yes. There's a part where Player X tells Molly that he doesn't like to play poker. He likes to destroy people's lives. That apparently is something that Maguire in real life said to her. Mm-hmm. And we should also mention that when a writer becomes a director, the normal stereotype about that is that the writer doesn't really know how to direct anything except having the actors deliver their words. And while I wouldn't put this visually on the same level as, say, The Social Network, or even Steve Jobs, or even The American President, which was more of a comedy and didn't really worry about the visuals too much, the movie does have some fairly distinctive touches here. You know, there's a somewhat different lighting from when they're playing in the bar that Dean is having all the games at, and the scenes in the hotel rooms where Molly is having her games in. You know, there is a little bit of more of a high-class lighting there to show that this is a more high-class setting. And also the way that the poker games are lit to the scenes of Molly and Charlie are lit. You know, there is some fairly distinctive visual style there. You know, again, we're not talking, you know, David Fincher level, but it still looks pretty good as a movie.
Yeah, there are definite like tonal shifts as well. So, for instance, like pretty much everything in the flashback of her as a skier looks very different from the whole rest of the film, especially in as much as, you know, there's narration throughout the film, but and again, you've got to do a lot of information dumping to give us some of the background on where she was, where she's been, where she's going, and so forth. But the other thing that, as I was watching it, and I remember when, you know, seeing it in the theater for the first time, and there is a lot of like graphics that are appearing on camera. So there's like, you know, drawing the angle so that shows that this slope is the same as one of the pyramids, and little arrows and circles and that sort of thing. And I was like, oh, no. I hope it's not going to be a whole film of this. And it turned out not to be. It was confined more or less to that scene. I think there was one other point where one of the players got like circled on screen. But for the most part, all that weird bit with the artwork getting drawn over the pictures confined itself to the skiing scenes.
Well, I think there's also a little bit of it in the scene where Bad Brad, who's played by Brian D'Arcy James, is playing with Harlan, who's played well by Bill Camp. And Harlan is the one guy there who's not a gambler. He's a real poker player.
Right. The cards are highlighted with rectangles.
Yes, and that works well. Now, this is in some ways a departure for Sorkin, in that this is the first thing he's written with a woman as the lead character. You know, all mm-hmm. of his other movies and TV shows, even though women play important roles in them, although we've discussed before how his writing of women isn't always up to par. And it's also the first movie that he's written where an African-American character takes prominence, even though he's played by an African-British actor, Idris Elba, mm-hmm. who I know best as playing Stringer Bell on The Wire.
Sure.
And by the way, he's not the only Wire alumnus in this movie. The lawyer who she consults with when she's starting the poker games on her own, who tells her not to break the law when she's breaking the law, is played by Michael Kosteroff, who played a sleazy lawyer on The Wire as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's sort of, not sort of, that is new territory for Sorkin. And I think he handles it pretty well for the most part. I know there was some criticism about the fact that her character seemed to have less agency as the movie goes on, especially in the scene where Molly and Charlie are with the prosecutor, and Charlie goes on this long, angry speech about how she shouldn't even be tried for this at all. She should just get community service. And she really doesn't get that much to talk about in this scene. He does most of the talking. Now, you could say that's normally how it is with lawyers and their clients, that the lawyer doesn't want their client saying too much. But I can see the point of people who sort of criticize that scene as not allowing her much agency.
Well, but that's exactly the argument that I would say is, like, basically that's his job and that's her job. Okay. Her job is to just shut up and let him do the talking. And his job is to make the big eloquent Sorkin-esque speech, you know, that's going to maybe sway the prosecutors. And the other thing is, this is a person who, you know, if she doesn't have much agency at that point in the film, well, it's because she doesn't have that much agency at that point in the story. Okay, so this is somebody who has, you know, starts out, you know, basically low person on the totem pole, works her way up, and then as things start to spiral out on her, yeah, she is going to lose agency. She's going to lose her agency to, you know, the fact that you've got the Russian and the Italian mafia are getting involved with the game. You've got the fact that she is now on, you know, abusing drugs and getting addicted and that kind of thing. So it's not even that part of it is she's losing it, and part of it is she is inadvertently handing it off because of, you know, her addictions. And so I think that it's a reasonable arc for this character to go through.
Okay. No, I can see that. I was just, you know, I was reading reviews about that lack of agency, and I could sort of see the point, but I also get what you're talking about there. Now, we should also mention that Jessica Chastain, before she was in this movie, she was in a movie called Miss Sloan, where she plays a manipulative lobbyist who actually joins a group of lawyers who are advocating on behalf of gun control. And if you ever watch that movie, it's not a great movie, but it's an interesting movie. And one of the things that's very interesting about it is that you could tell the script was written by someone who was a fan of Sorkin's, because it's done very much in his style, not just the dialogue, but also the themes that he's drawn to in the political world. So you could say that this was Miss Sloan was sort of a warm-up for Chastain coming here with Molly's Game. And one thing I also want to get to is a lot of Sorkin's stories are also about friendships. You know, in A Few Good Men, you've got the friendship between Tom Cruise and Kevin Pollak's characters. In The American President, you've got the friendship between Michael Douglas and Martin Sheen. Sports Night and The West Wing, of course, are full of friendships. And Molly's Game has a gradual friendship between Molly and Charlie as Molly learns to trust that Charlie's not going to screw her over, even though she doesn't agree with his methods. And Charlie learns to take her seriously and to actively fight for her as a client. There's even a nice little banter scene that I love when Charlie's daughter Stella comes in to give her father an essay that she's written, well, as Charlie would say, two paragraphs about three poems that have a common theme of being one-word titles. And Molly turns to Stella and says to her, you know, if you get tired of him, you can come live with me. And then Charlie banters back, that's when you'll learn that she doesn't have a home, so you have to stay with me. And then Stella leaves, and And Molly yells out at her, there's no law that says you can't just hit him in the head. And Charlie says, oh, yes, there is. It's actually the first thing I taught her. So, you know, he's very good at little friendship moments like that. And that was a good one.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's kind of interesting, and I know I'm going off on a weird tangent here, but it occurs to me that a lot of the extras in the poker playing scenes were themselves like professional poker players, so that they could you know handle the cards in a very professional manner. And was Joshua Molina not available for this film?
I don't know. He hasn't worked on a Sorkin project. Or Sorkin movie, we should say, rather, since The American President. So I don't know. Mm. But maybe he was, he's on a couple TV shows, or he was at the time. Maybe that kept him from doing it. But yeah, Sorkin does go for, even though he changes all the names, you know, he does go for making things done at least in the background as realistically as possible, sort of as a nice way of playing off that the dialogue is heightened realism, such as especially whenever Chris O'Dowd, as the player who is the one who finks Molly out to the FBI, ultimately, that his dialogue, as she says, always sounds like, the first line he always says to her, always sounds like a line or a title of a cheap film noir or crime novel.
Right.
And you also get that funny scene where he completely misquotes Robert Frost. And he says to her, you like poetry? And she says, I didn't till a second ago.
Yeah.
So that's another commonality. And then going back to what we talked about in Steve Jobs, this movie has parental issues. Mm-hmm. And that Rosebud moment. I don't know if you mentioned in the summation, Molly's father is played by Kevin Costner.
I think I left that out,
and unfortunately. He's a psychiatrist, which is sort of appropriate as well for what we're talking about here. And you see in some of the flashbacks to the skiing things how Molly and her father do not get along at all. There's a whole dinner table discussion where she brings up how much of a misogynist Freud was. And to say her father doesn't like that is pretty much of an understatement. Her father's name is Larry, by the way, I should mention. And then at the end, or in the climax, I should say, after Molly leaves that meeting with Charlie and the prosecutors, she goes to an ice skating rink in, I don't remember if it's Bryant Park or Central Park.
Yeah, it's the Woolman Rink in okay. Central Park.
And all of a sudden, when she's skating and run away or skating away fast from one of the park security people there who's trying to get her to slow down, she sees her father and literally runs into someone. And then they have a whole discussion when they're sitting down on why she never liked him or why he never liked her.
Last question.
No, I have to go.
Last question, Mom. I'll answer it, but you have to ask it. You have to ask it.
Why didn't you like me as much as my brothers?
There it is. I did. It only from time to time appeared that I didn't.
It only appeared that you didn't.
Yeah.
That is some Schedule One bullshit. Why would it only appear? Okay, I had an attitude problem. I talked back. I broke some normal adolescent rules. I snuck phone time after curfew. I took your car when I wasn't allowed to.
Drove it into a McDonald's.
And kids get punished for that, but
did
they don't.
Did you not see the McDonald's? I mean, did you misunderstand what drive-through meant?
You turn into a different person. Your voice, your face.
You knew.
I didn't hear what you said.
I said, I knew you knew.
You knew I knew what?
That I was cheating on Mom. I knew you knew.
No, I didn't know until I was 20.
No, you'd known since you were 5. You saw me in my car and you really didn't know what you saw. You knew, honey. And I knew you knew, and that's how I reacted to the shame. And you reacted by showing seething contempt for me. Driving my car into Donald's.
Again, that points back not only to the parental issue theme that Sorkin is always interested in, but also the Rosebud moment. The Rosebud moment here in this case is A, when she was 5, Molly witnessed Larry cheating on her mother, even though she didn't really know what it was at the time. And B, this according to Larry, that when she had that skiing accident, she tripped on a stick. And this is Larry's way of telling her, look, you didn't do anything wrong.
Right, right, right. But it's interesting because it's not that she's basically baiting him every time they get into the arguments. It's not like, you know, he says something that she disagrees with. You know, she's basically looking for the weak spot, and she's going to poke that bear whenever they have those confrontations, you know, especially in those earlier flashbacks. You know, she probably doesn't really care one way or the other about, you know, how Freud operates, but she knows what he thinks, and so she's going to say something just to tick him off.
And that's why when he comes out with that at the end, it's such a shock to her.
Mm-hmm.
That she's almost, that she's speechless at first. And then when he goes into the fact that he's going into full father mode, you know, I'm going to find the guy who beat you up.
Right.
And I'm going to get him killed. She's like, no, it's okay. And Kevin Costner, I must say, is really good here. He who had been acting like the total controlling parent and total controlling doctor, he's the one who comes apart.
Yeah, he starts breaking up a little bit.
Yeah,
so and he lets it come through in his voice, and his facial expression. You start to see him start to crumble a little bit.
Right, and another part of that scene, which is more in the background. And the fact that it's in the background, I thought, was a nice touch. We've talked a little before about how Sorkin can sometimes be heavy-handed in his choice of songs. Sometimes it's a good thing. Sometimes he makes it work, like in the second season finale of The West Wing when Brothers in Arms comes on by Dire Straits. When the president is doing his walk in the rain, you know, that's an obvious moment, but a powerful one anyway. But sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it can just seem obvious. But in the background of the skating scene, when she starts skating and when she starts having this long talk with Larry, her father, a cover version of Heart's These Dreams starts playing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a song from the 80s when they had other people come in and write their songs, not Ann and Nancy Wilson. And it's about a woman dreaming about her ex-lover coming back. And the lyrics don't necessarily point completely to the subtext of Molly's feelings toward her father, but they sort of hint at it a little. And the fact that Sorkin is using that as background, not playing over the scene as score, is much more subtle than you'd usually give him credit for.
It is. And the lyrics for that song were written by Bernie Taupin, who usually yes. partners up with Elton John. And, you know, that's pretty much how he operates when he writes. He likes to put a little bit of, not subtlety. He likes to be a little bit vague about, you know, whom the character is singing to in general or about. You know,
right.
he tends to couch it in broader phrases. So you won't hear a lot of "I love you, girl." It'll just be "I love you," kind of stuff. And to make it like something that more people can interpret as something to which they can relate.
Right. And again, that's the fact that it's done, you know, just as a little part of the scene instead of showcasing it, makes that moment for me all the more powerful. Now, we also get an example in this movie of Sorkin dropping something in the beginning of the movie and then only bringing it back at the end without hitting the note about it. And that's the Arthur Miller play, The Crucible.
Yes.
Because at the beginning, or near the early on, I should say, when Molly is first waiting in Charlie's office and she sees Stella there, Stella is reading The Crucible and Molly hasn't read it yet, but she does this whole thing about how witches weren't actually burnt at the stake. And then at the very end, when Charlie is trying to get Molly to take this deal so that she can get her money back, and she refuses to, and he gets very frustrated and yells at her, why? She says, because it's my name and it's all I have left, which is a line from the play. And Charlie's reaction to that is memorable.
Is this self-imposed punishment for naming four guys in a book?
It's not.
You didn't do anything wrong.
I threw four people under the bus for $35,000, Charlie. I noticed you kept that out of your speech to the prosecutor.
No, don't do that.
I took advantage of gambling addicts. Donnie Silverman, my brilliant find. He lost
Marty,
$6 million
stop.
On my table.
Stop.
Moved to Florida, uh-huh. got a job as a substitute teacher, then hanged himself.
Oh, and
in
that's
his shower.
Your fault. That's
Donnie
not
Silverman's
your fault.
Dead. Harlan Eustace is in jail in Nevada, wishing he was, but that's not why I'm saying no.
You're not saying no.
I was named after my great grandmother.
I don't care.
Molly.
We
Dublin
will stay
Bloom
here all night until
name.
You understand. Until you understand, nobody gives a shit about your good name.
I do.
Why?
Because.
Why?
Because.
Tell me why.
Because it's all I have left. Because it's my name. And I'll never have another.
Now you read The Crucible?
Yeah, everyone's right. It's great.
And one thing I learned, I don't know if you read the New York Times regularly, but when they post the reviews of movies, on some movies, they'll have what they call anatomy of a scene, where the creator, the director, writer discusses a particular scene in the movie. And the one scene that Sorkin chose to discuss in talking about this movie with the Times is the scene where Charlie first accompanies Molly to court, where he claims he's just going to be there for the purpose of the hearing, not to actually represent her. And in the scene, while the judge, played by Graham Greene, the actor, not the writer, we should say,
yeah,
is hearing pleas from all the other defendants involved in this case, Charlie switches places with Molly's bodyguards a couple times.
Yeah, repeatedly.
Yeah, well, three times. And Sorkin said that in the script, which I did read before I saw the movie, but didn't get a chance to reread before this discussion, that there were actually four times that he interrupted her, but he cut it down to three because, according to him, odd numbers or an odd number of things happening are funnier than even numbers or an even number of things happening. Now, I don't know. I haven't really done a study of that to see if it's necessarily true, but it is something to think about.
I know comedians refer to like the rule of threes, where you do two things to set up the pattern and then the third subverts the pattern. I'm not sure if this really applies quite the same way, but yeah, I get it.
Oh, we should also point out, there is one difference that I do remember from the book and the movie besides the trial, and that's the character of Dean. And Jeremy Strong, by the way, is also in the trial of Chicago 7. He plays Jerry Rubin. Mm-hmm. But in the book, when Dean forces Molly out of the game, and then Molly decides, okay, hell with him, I'm going to create my own game and steal all his players, it turns out that, according to Molly anyway, he knew that she was starting to outgrow him. You know, she knows more about his business, aside from the poker game, than he does, to know that he's not running it well. And this is his way of saying, okay, fly out on your own. You don't need me anymore. Whereas in the movie, it's just him being a jerk to her. So it's interesting that Sorkin, who I remember saying, I remember reading at the time that The Social Network came out, you know, that he is interested in writing characters who may be awful in a lot of ways, but trying to find that one redeeming factor in them, would choose to cut out this redeeming factor. Although whether or not you think it's a real redeeming factor or not, I guess is up to you.
Well, it kind of is. And I think that would actually, now we go back to what we were talking about her gaining agency. Okay. Mm-hmm. Where basically she is forced to grow a little bit because this guy has kind of, you know, cut her legs out from under her and she's got to recover somehow. So it actually works in that favor of building her up as a character who is taking on, you know, her own agency and becoming a more independent person. It makes good story sense.
Okay. Now, I don't have anything else to talk about here. Do you?
Well, we've got the Sorkinisms here, and there are a few. Okay. First of all, you had to notice the agency, the legal firm that Charlie works for.
Oh yes, Gage Whitney.
Yes.
Is the firm that Sam worked for in season two flashback in The West Wing.
Correct. And also there was a scene, I think it's in a bar, it has a brick wall and there's something painted on the back of the wall.
That is, let's see here. Oh, Quo Vadimus.
There you go. All right.
Yeah.
And there actually is a scene with, it's not the running joke like they did in Steve Jobs with Andy, but there is a quick exchange between two characters where basically the name is confused because it's one of the prosecutors talking about he's been reading transcripts and it says, "Where's Molly? Get Molly. We need Molly." And she has to correct them that they were talking about methamphetamine.
Right. And then there's another name thing that I just remembered as well. The character played by Charlie O'Dowd, when he hears the name, that her name is Molly Bloom. His name is Douglas Downey, by the way, and yes. Christopher O'Dowd. I'm sorry, not Charlie. He thinks that because Molly Bloom is a character in James Joyce's Ulysses, that she is Irish, when in fact she's a Russian Jew.
Right.
Which is why she's able to get the Russian mob, as well as some of the people who do the dirty work, to play with her in the first place. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a Sorkinism per se, but the whole scene where she, sort of like the name, the Shelley, the guy who launders money and also owns an art gallery, or Shelby, you know, he finds the woman who greets him at the door is named Shelley. Oh, we're just a letter apart.
Right.
And then the scene where he brings in the Monet to be a security deposit, and Molly's like, please be careful with the painting, take it back and I'll give you a line of credit.
Yeah.
You know, that's the whole discussion about the painting sort of reminded me of a joke they did about paintings in the West Wing episode 2. But that's the Christmas episode in season 2 when they're talking about the paintings in the White House there. You know, it's not specific. It just reminded me sort of that vibe there. Okay. Anything else you want to say about this before we wrap it up?
No, that's it. I've exhausted my notes now.
Okay. So Molly's Game and Steve Jobs are both available to stream at Netflix
if you subscribe.
And they're also available to buy or rent at many of the other streaming services, including Amazon, YouTube, Google Play, and Apple TV. And next week, or next episode, will be part 4 of our Sorkin Fest. And we're going to step back a little to talk about 2 movies where he wasn't the only credited writer on them, even though his style is pretty distinctive in both of them. Malice, which came out in 1983, and Moneyball, which came out in 2011.
Yes, and Malice is, as far as I know, it's not available for free streaming anywhere. You can rent it on Apple TV. You can buy it through most of your major distributors. Moneyball is available on the Netflix, and you can rent or buy it through most of your major outlets.
And I think it's also streaming on Stars.
Yes. I'm sorry. It is.
Okay. And to wrap things up, if you have a question or comment, you can always email us to wordsandmoviepod@gmail.com. And you can find me, Sean Gallagher, on Facebook.
You can find the show on the Twitter machine at Words and Movies Pod. You can find me on the web at my other podcast, How Good It Is, on howgooditis.com and on Twitter at How Good It Is.
Okay, so we'll see you next time.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
This is your announcer, Rebecca Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Mophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Anchor.fm. If you want to support the show, go to anchor.fm/wordsandmovies and click on the support link. Who knows? Maybe they'll even kick a few bucks my way. Thanks for listening.